You are listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Eric Schultzke. I'm going to start this conversation with the most memorable dream that I have ever had. It was actually two dreams back to back on successive nights. I don't remember a lot of dreams, but in this case, I remembered them both like in vivid detail. And not only did I remember them, but when I woke up each morning, I knew that those dreams had a purpose, that it was not random. I grew up in Northern California in the Sierra foothills in fire country. When I was a kid, there was a fire that came through our area, and I remember being out there. We had hoses and we were spraying on roofs. Many, many years later, when I was married and we had young children, our oldest child at this point was about 9, I dreamt that we were at my parents' house and that we got word that there was a fire. Rather than taking precautionary measures or trying to get out, we hopped in a car and drove to a ridge. And I actually know the place. It was a real place. I drove to a ridge and we looked over the canyon. The fire was sweeping up that canyon toward us. And because we had gone to look at it instead of getting away from it, we had to race back to the house and we threw just a few possessions in the car and just fled. The next night, I dreamt again of a fire. The same story, only this time, instead of going to the canyon to look at the fire like idiots, we started trying to create defensible space around the home. We got out chainsaws and we started cutting down trees and clearing away brush. Now, I recommend that if you're in this situation, you do this before the fire is on its way. Creating defensible space during a fire is not your best strategy. When I got up after that second morning, I immediately knew what the dream meant. We were in the midst of some form of contagion that was going to put our children at risk if we didn't create an insulated culture that allowed them to develop naturally. Now, if you put us back in 2004, 2005, that was a pretty dicey time. It hasn't gotten any better since. Our kids are okay. They're all adults now. We have two grandkids, and I think they made it. So we have with us on the line somebody who might be able to help us figure this out, and he's not a shaman. He's a scientist. He's actually down in Brazil. Siddhartha Ribeiro, who is the author of The Oracle of Night, The History and Science of Dreams. Siddhartha, you had a question about my dream.
Right. So you had a metaphorical dream, right? Because
oh, the absolutely.
Dream was about fire. But then the situation that you were worried about was about a condition, right?
Right. And I read in your book that that's actually just standard practice in dreaming.
Absolutely. Exactly. Yeah. So this is an important thing to consider, is that dreams are related to our concerns, to our desires, in this case, to your subliminal perception that something was really wrong, but it doesn't have to be literal in order to be premonitory.
For those who are hearing at home, premonitory would be related to the word premonition, which is foreseeing something that might happen, right? So premonitory, right. It's a great word. You should bank it, people. Premonitory, keep going.
or precognitive, right?
I like premonitory. I think it's fun. Now, you talk about the problem solving. That's a big part of your book, but it's also a relatively recent and controversial part of the science of dreams and neuroscience, right?
Well, 20 years ago, you could call it controversial, but no longer. For example, Robert Stickold in Harvard has been publishing since 2010 evidence in the best possible journals that when you dream about solving a task, you become better at solving it. And it's not just a question of thinking about it. If you think about it during waking, it doesn't have the same effect.
Right.
So I don't think it's controversial anymore. I think it's time for us to update our notions about what dreaming really is.
And yet, there was a time not very long ago where people thought that dreaming was random and that it would serve no purpose and that it was just like these neurons firing that weren't really doing anything.
Well, I think that during the 20th century, there was a separation between depth psychology, Freud, Jung, and many other contributors, on one side and neuroscience on the other side.
I want to take a step back, though, and talk a little bit about Freud, because I have a confession to make. As recently as 3 or 4 years ago, my son got married and we were at a dinner and I was talking to his new father-in-law. He was talking about Freud and how they went to a psychoanalytic conference. And I was just like, I was dismissive. And I was I was just like, Freud, people still do that? And to be honest, your book is the first time where I've got like, I need to go back to him and say, you know, mea culpa, my bad.
Well, it's good to hear that. I think that, you know, Freud never stopped considering himself a scientist, but he did stop to use the biological concepts of his time to advance and took a leap into a psychological theory of his own, right? And he was heavily criticized for doing this. But I side with Konrad Lorenz. I mentioned him in the book, Nobel Prize winner, one of the founders of animal behavior, who said in the 1940s that Freud and Jung, Carl Jung, would be totally vindicated by time because they had a very strong scientific mentality. And the concepts they were postulating based on very keen observation of human behavior would be eventually corroborated by empirical biological approaches. This is exactly what just happened in the past 20 years.
Okay, so I want you to tell me the story of how you first discovered Freud's writing on dreams.
So this is interesting. I was, you know, dreams played a very important role in my life from early on, and some of that described in the book. But it was not until I was beginning my PhD that they became something professionally important for me. I was starting my PhD at Rockefeller University in New York City. That was 1995. But I ended up arriving late for the year. My class started in September or late August, but I only arrived in January of next year. And so when I arrived, I was totally out of rhythm with the other students, and it was very stressful for me. It was also winter, and I'm coming from Brazil. You know, from the summer in Brazil, and I arrive in New York, and it's very dark and very cold, and I knew pretty much nobody. And for the first couple of weeks, I even felt that I couldn't anymore understand English. Not just I couldn't understand the biology that was discussed in the seminars, but I couldn't understand language itself.
And the way you describe it, it almost like it was bordering on madness.
It was actually bordering on depression. But I didn't feel sad. I just felt that I needed to sleep a lot. And I started to resist this urge to sleep. And I said, you know, I'll go to the lab, just work hard. And then, you know, over time I will habituate. But then I couldn't stay awake at all. I was sleeping in the lab, dozing all the time. And then at some point I said, you know what, I'll go to my room and I'll sleep as much as I need. And then I started to sleep more and more and dream a lot. And that took about 2 months, 2.5 months. And then when spring came, and I was really starting to feel that my body was sabotaging me, and it was preventing me from advancing and from doing what I needed to do in order to a good student, a good first year student. Then when spring came and the sun came back, suddenly I adapted. And then over the course of less than a month, I went from being totally isolated to being, you know, very well related to other people. I have very good friends that are like brothers and sisters to me to this day. And then I started research that ended up being very successful. I published it well. My career blossomed during my PhD. And then I realized...
Yeah, but you also, your English came back like all of a sudden.
The English came back miraculously. Clearly a situation of lack of access to something that was already known, which is something very keen to Freud.
So
then when it came out of this, I said, okay, so this process that seemed like it was a sabotage for my own body was in fact an adaptation process. And then what is out there? What can I learn about this in neuroscience? And I realized there was very little. And then I realized there was a literature from the 60s and 70s that was very contested at the time, linking memory processing and sleep, right? Something that became really established in the past two decades wasn't back then. And then I remembered something about Freud, something that was related to pop culture. And I said, Freud has something to say about this. So I went to Strand and got a $5 copy of complete works of Freud.
Used bookstore.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. So it was a whole, when I remember it, it's like a movie because, you know, suddenly I had access to all this thinking about dreams that said they are not random. I think this is important. This is something you said early on, that the notion that dreaming is random is totally contrary to all the tradition that we have in our history, in our prehistory. And if we consider current hunter-gatherers that continue to cultivate dreams, this notion couldn't be more wrong. So now I think what we are ready to do is to understand how can it be that a neurobiological process generates guesses about the future.
Okay, so let me inject something here. You use the word extravagance to describe dreaming. Explain to us what you mean by that.
Right. So when we dream, we undergo a process of reactivation of memories. However, these memories are not just replayed as if we were waking. They are reactivated and associated in manners that are more free than during waking life. This has to do with the neurochemistry of REM sleep, the state of sleep that occupies the second half of the night. And this is when we have the most vivid dreams.
And so my understanding from you is that the pattern over the night is that you start with slow wave sleep, which is then has little pieces of REM sleep interspliced in it. And then as the night goes on, the REM becomes longer and longer and more, you know, pervasive.
Exactly. Okay. So regularly we get four or five of those full cycles that end up with REM sleep. And they get longer and longer. And that means that our dream experience also becomes more complex, richer, and has a duration that allows us to simulate very complex behaviors. This kind of reactivation, the memory reactivation that occurs during REM sleep is noisy. And it is noisy again because of the lack of some neurotransmitters such as norepinephrine. And because it's noisier, your dream is not going to be a copy of something you have lived in waking life, but it will be a version of it, and it will have parts of different experiences. In my book, I go through an evolutionary conjecture to imagine how could it be that this oracle property, this property of premonition, of simulating a possible future, came to be. Basically, what I propose is that this started to evolve a good 200, 220 million years ago as our most remote mammalian ancestors began to extend in duration the REM sleep state.
Okay, so I want to just take a step back here. The oracle function, I mean, this is the title of your book, The Oracle of Night. What do we mean by that?
So what we mean by this is the notion that a dream can simulate a future, a potential future, a counterfactual, something that may happen and may not happen as well, depending on our own behavior. So this is very well documented from the very early moments of history. So when we look into the earliest texts of humankind in Sumeria, 4,500 years ago, we'll see dreams portrayed as premonitory mental objects, as experiences that foretold future. So everywhere we look, if we look into Sumerian texts, into Babylonian texts, into Akkadian texts, texts from ancient Egypt, Greece, Rome, China, India, everywhere we'll find that people were having dreams that were interpreted as depictions of possible futures. And this was tremendously important. No king, no queen, no general would go to war, would make peace, without consulting this dream oracle. When people were sick, they would go to the temple of a god related to good health, like Serapis in Egypt, or Aesculapius in Greece, Asclepius in Rome, or Apollo himself. And they would sleep inside the temple and ask for a diagnosis and treatment coming from the gods during the dream. So dreams were a portal, a gateway, to contact those godlike entities that could bring all those things, as well as plans for public buildings. You know, weddings would depend on this. So all the social life was organized around dreaming. And this was so through the Middle Ages, in Christianity, in Islam. And it's still so among current hunter-gatherers, among Amerindian, among Native Americans, among Aboriginal peoples in Australia.
But you're going to tell us how a scientific skeptic can make sense of all this.
Okay, so there's a little story that comes with it. So let's imagine our earliest mammalian ancestor, an animal that looked a little bit like a mouse, that occupied a very narrow niche, a very narrow ecological niche, because the world was already dominated by dinosaurs. And this animal was every day trying to cope with the what I like to call the Darwinian imperatives of killing something to eat, not being eaten by anybody, not dying, and then eventually breeding. So these were the main problems, and these are the main problems of any animal in nature. And these are still our main problems as humans. Although,
well, you know what? My dream fits into that framework.
Absolutely.
I'm trying to make sure that my kids came through.
Mm-hmm. It was about survival. Dreaming is about survival and breeding. Originally in mammals, of course, in humans, it's way more complicated than that, right? But this is how it begins. So it begins, let's imagine our great-great-great-great-great-grandmother looking for water. She's thirsty. And then she thinks that maybe there's water that is good in this particular place. And then she goes there in a lagoon. And then when she's about to have her sip, crocodile attacks. And it misses, but she's very scared. And she goes back to her place and she goes to sleep thirsty. Now, of course, when she had this experience, the neurons that represent this place, the visual scene, the body position in the space that represents in particular the features of the crocodile that was missed, and they represent all that in the context of a lot of fear. So we're talking about a lot of adrenaline and norepinephrine, and we're talking about cortisol. So all that is at play to make this memory very strong. Those synapses are going to be strengthened. There's going to be long-term potentiation there. There's going to be long-term depression in adjacent circuits so that the contrast will be increased. And there's going to be basically a favored, let's say the passive electrical activity will become facilitated along this mesh of neurons that represents this entire memory.
It sounds to me kind of like a really high contrast, high saturation photograph with high detail, as opposed to kind of like a blurry, faded photo from the 70s.
Exactly. So it's a strong memory, an emotional memory. Those are the memories that really stick, right? So our ancestor goes to sleep. And then when she goes to sleep, she's no longer receiving incoming sensory information, but the brain is generating endogenous activity, generated very deep in the pons, in the mesencephalon, and then reaching to the cortex, right? When this activity reaches the cortex, it will find this brand new memory very fresh and very strong, and then it will activate this memory. And electrical activity will reverberate through this mesh of neurons that represent this entire situation, and our great-great-grandmother will have a nightmare. She will re-experience that situation. She will go through the whole situation again. Of course, it will not be exactly the same, exactly because we have a lack of norepinephrine and there's more freedom for the spread of electrical activity, then the contents may change. Maybe the crocodile will be bigger. Maybe it will be two. Maybe it will be a dinosaur.
One of the things that she's doing right now is she's blending memories over time.
Absolutely. She's gonna integrate this with her whole past. And this is all going to be coming to register at this moment. Then she's going to engage also those brain areas related to emotions like the amygdala. And so she will have a very bad time again, you know. But then up to this moment, we cannot talk about the oracle, because what's really happening here is the reactivation of a memory. So this is just about the past. The magic happens when she wakes up. When she wakes up in the morning, she will wake up coming from this experience again. And though she will feel frightened, she'll be scared, and she will be also thirsty, and she will want to go to the same place and drink water because there's water there. But she'll also have this fear and those images reverberating, and now for the third time telling her maybe it's not a good idea. And then if she changes her course of action, if she changes her behavior, if instead of going to the same place she does something different, she's creative about it, she goes farther away but it's in a safer place and survives. So there was a little advantage, a little cognitive advantage.
Let me clarify what I think is happening here. I just want to bring the listener along. she will replay these events in her mind over and over again, probably on successive nights. Mm-hmm. And as she replays them, she will integrate different experiences she's had and different options and opportunities to respond to the problem. And then so there will be learning that's occurring in the dreaming. And then eventually at some point, there's going to be a magic moment where she wakes up with an insight.
Absolutely. Well, actually, it doesn't have to be over many days. It can be, but it can be overnight. I'll tell you an example. When I was more or less halfway through my PhD, I was starting to do experiments in the field in Millbrook, less than 2 hours away from New York by car. And the lab had two cars for that. And then I signed up for one of those cars and I came to the lab early in the morning to get it. And I realized that they were both gone. One was supposed to be gone, but the other one was supposed to be in New York. And then I was really angry because I realized that one of my colleagues had stayed overnight there without having planned, and my experiment was ruined. And I got really, really angry at him, and I waited for an apology, and he didn't. And so I decided to talk to him in person when he came back the next day. When I went to sleep, I had a dream in which I would come to the lab, find him, and scold him. And then he would beat me up badly. And he's a big guy, strong guy. Then I woke up in the morning and I thought about that dream and I said, I should be gentle with him. So I met him and I told him how I felt, but in a very sober manner. And he was also very sober. So I think this is an example in which I simulated.
You didn't necessarily think that he was going to beat you up physically.
No.
It might just ruin your relationship, but that was a metaphor again.
Yes, exactly. So it could develop into a fist fight. But it didn't have to develop into that in order to ruin our relationship. And so I think that these simulations of possible futures, and especially of things that can go wrong, gave mammals an advantage, gave them an edge. And this edge, after dinosaurs were gone, allowed mammals to radiate, to occupy all possible ecological niches from the North Pole to the South Pole, all deserts, forests. Mammals are all over the place. And they're characterized by being very good at not only dreaming, but playing.
Oh, dreaming and playing, that's a big deal.
And this is something that really differs between, say, mammals and reptiles. Reptiles are very good at doing the three basic things of killing, not dying, and breeding. But mammals can do many other things.
It's imagination.
It has to do with this ability to fantasize.
Yeah.
To imagine.
So imagination, play, and dreaming are all closely, these are the same things. They're intertwined.
Absolutely. You know? When you look into the brain areas that get activated when we have dreaming during sleep, those are the areas that we also engage when we imagine the future, when we imagine the past, when we tell a story, when we have empathy for others. So all those regions, which collectively we call the default mode network, the DMN, are where the representation of ourselves, as well as the representation of all the other beings that exist out there that we have met or that we have read about or seen on screens, they live together in this collection of brain areas that go across the entire brain. This is the substrate of this environment of simulation that gave us such a strong cognitive advantage over other animal groups.
We're speaking here with Siddhartha Ribeiro, a Brazilian neuroscientist whose new book is titled The Oracle of Night, The History and Science of Dreams. Up next, we're going to learn a little bit more about the hard science of dreams and memory, which involves some serious work with rat brains. This is Constant Wonder. Glad to have you along for Constant Wonder today. Our guest this hour is Siddhartha Ribeiro, a Brazilian neuroscientist at the Federal University of North Rio Grande in Natal, Brazil. Siddhartha, you say there's been an upheaval in neuroscience in the past 20 years that has revived interest in dreaming, and in doing so has brought Sigmund Freud back into the mainstream. But you didn't just watch this happen. You were actually a big part of it.
Sure. I mean, this is my career. I'm a neuroscientist.
You killed a lot of rats. Let's talk about some of your dead rats.
I mean, I'm not proud of it. I think that in the future, science will will know so much that he won't have to do it. But for the
I wasn't trying to make you feel bad. I wanted to note that you do hard science. So let's talk about your rats. You had a story where you almost lost some rat brains.
Yes. I tell the story in the book. I had finished my PhD and I had this idea with one of my collaborators, mentors, Konstantin Pavlidis, and also with Claudio Mello, who was one of my advisors, my main advisor. And the idea had to be realized over the course of 2 months in winter, because after that, we wouldn't have the facilities and we would just, it was just do it or forget about it. And so I engaged in this experiment and I started doing every day without missing a single one, because we had to be very precise. And then finally, when I got all the experiments done and all these, we were looking to gene expression in the brains of rats, and we wanted to investigate how memories move around and whether REM sleep plays a role in that. And then that was before 9/11, so airports were much messier than today. I ended up going to LaGuardia. I had to ship all these brains in dry ice. And there was a complication, and I had to switch airplanes and go through a different company. And when I got to Raleigh, the brains were not there. And they were not there in the next flight, and not in the next flight, and not the next day. And so I don't want to give a spoiler. Basically, it was a very anxious waiting for this material to arrive. And I don't want to say what happened.
All right. So setting aside that, let's talk about what the research was about, because that is fascinating stuff. You're talking about the hippocampus, and is that how you pronounce it? Hippocampus?
Yes.
And the cerebral cortex. And what's happening during sleep is that memories of the day, and this is funny because one thing that Freud invented the phrase, the residue of the day. And that, it turns out, is exactly what dreaming is about, right? The hippocampus is processing the residue of the day, and then as it does it, it's shoving those memories out into the cerebral cortex for storage, and they go further and further into it. Is that right?
Exactly. This is exactly the experiment that I was doing back then, and we were able to show in 2002, this was published in 2002 in the Journal of Neuroscience, that as REM sleep recurs, as you go from the first episode to the second and so on, the reactivation of the hippocampus that is very strong early on, it fades away and the cortex takes over. And what is reactivated in those experiments, what we observed is the expression of a specific gene related to long-term memory, a gene that helps synaptic remodeling.
I mean, this is amazing stuff. There's a moment in your book where you say, you know what, Karl Popper said that Freud could never be proven scientifically because his theories were not scientific. And you said he was wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yes. The first empirical evidence that the day residue is a fact of observation was published in 1989 by Konstantin Pavlidis and Jonathan Winson at Rockefeller University. It's also a Journal of Neuroscience paper. They showed that the neurons in the hippocampus that experience more activity during waking also are those that show more activity during sleep. So this is like an electrophysiological or electrical day residue. Years later, in 1999, I published the first evidence, also with Konstantin Pavlidis and Claudio Mello, that this happens at the molecular level through the expression of this gene that I mentioned before called ZIP268. So we can say that day residue is a concept that was empirically validated at the electrical and at the molecular level.
Yeah, it's uncanny. But one of the things we're talking about here is how much is in your unconscious, which is, again, is a Freudian thing, right? But that we have memories and ideas and connections, and a lot of those are being made and reprocessed and played with in our sleep. And you emphasize that the play in sleep is important because we can't really do any damage.
Exactly. So if the little cub tiger had to learn how to hunt the buffalo, by hunting the buffalo, he would die on the first attempt. The way that mammals learn how to hunt, the predators, say lions or tigers, they learn how to do that is by playing with their siblings. And this is what we see ourselves. I mean, we are animals that do not become mature until many years after. And we learn so many things under the protection of parental care. And this allows us to be born with a huge brain, with huge neurons, many synapses that have no memories, but they can learn a lot. So this is an environment, a protected environment. Play has an important role of mixing reality, external reality, with inner reality, with imagination. And this is at the essence of this behavior that allows us to acquire so much culture, so much, let's say, software on this hardware without having to face reality as harsh as it is. It's very different from the situation of, say, an alligator or a shark. When they get out of the egg, they are already mini adults. They're ready to go and kill, not die, and breed. Mm-hmm. They will just grow and grow and grow and grow, and the behavior won't change that much. But in the case of mammals, behaviors change completely. And we see animals that are very nice and cute, like a newly born tiger, become a very strong predator because of the scaffolding of the parental care and the ability to simulate.
Okay, I have always considered birds to be honorary mammals. Do they dream?
They probably do, because they have something very similar to REM sleep. They have what we call active sleep also in reptiles, and also recently fruit flies, and very recently octopuses. My lab has published evidence this year that the octopus has something like REM sleep. But all these animals, octopus, fruit flies, reptiles, and birds, have very short episodes of REM sleep, or active sleep, if you want. Mm-hmm. Right? They can go up to, say, a couple of minutes. That's very different from mammals. Mammals can go up to dozens of minutes, up to an hour. The platypus goes beyond an hour. And this allows us, mammals, to not just have little clips, GIFs of reactivation, but rather movies, rather stories, rather, you know, complex plots that can give us insights into much more complex social situations.
There's so much that we know that we don't know that we know. Have you ever come across a book that was published in 1998 by a guy named Gary Klein? It's called Sources of Power. It was published by MIT Press, so it was solid stuff. If you ever wanted to investigate the real science behind Malcolm Gladwell's blink, it's there in Gary Klein's book, Sources of Power. But he goes through case after case of firemen and nurses in neonatal intensive care units. They were responding, not knowing why they were responding. They would respond and say, this is a crisis, and start handling it like a crisis. And then they would go back and say, well, how do you know it was a crisis? And they wouldn't know. And then they would try to reconstruct it scientifically, and usually they would be able to figure it out that there was some cue that these people were recognizing based on their years of experience, and they didn't even know that it was a cue they were responding to.
Right. So you're talking here about something that is related to intuition. You could call dreaming a very sophisticated manner of intuition, which is to integrate a lot of subliminal stimuli into a supraliminal image. That means getting a lot of stuff that is getting to your brain and getting to your unconscious, all right, but not available to conscious. And then putting it all together, mending it together, and generating an image that can be very literal, mm-hmm. but also can be at many times allegorical.
But in these cases, it actually is like this little module of stimulus and reaction that the subconscious mm-hmm. has packaged for them, and yes. it just kind of totally bypasses conscious decision making.
Yes, it will bias your behavior even if you're not aware of it. However, right. if you are aware of it, if you pay attention to your dreams, for example, and if you have a dream diary, and if you analyze the dreams in context, then you learn a lot. You gain a lot of insight into your challenges, into your desires, and into the future.
One of the fun things about your book is it's not just like, oh, and here's what we know. It's like, here's what you can do at home.
Yes, yes. Let's think about this. It's only in the past 500 years, in the traditions that arose from Europe, that dreams lost traction. All the other cultures considered and still consider dreaming a very essential thing for living, right? But in the Eurocentric culture, that about 500 years ago, it became illegitimate to use dreams to justify any decision, so, right? If you went, you know, 1,000 years ago in the Middle Ages, a king said, I need to wage a war because I had a dream, that would be fine. But then in the past 500 years, if people said, let's get some funds in order to do to send ships to the east and bring goods to the west, based on a dream, that would not fly. That would not make any sense. A CEO couldn't call a board of directors and say, we need to do some investments based on a dream. So dreams are no longer a mental object that can justify any decision with a social impact.
Really quickly, tell us about the sewing machine needle, because it does happen.
Right. So this is interesting because we have a lot of evidence of dreaming making creativity stronger, right, in the arts and also in science. But it also has a very concrete economic impact on people's lives. In the 19th century, people were obsessed about having a sewing machine that could produce clothes with all the textiles that were produced in mass. So there was an urgent need for innovation. And then Elias Howe had this dream in which he was captured by a group of savages that had a king, and the king told him, you need to build this machine by the end of the day, otherwise we'll kill you. And he was, you know, suffering and couldn't find the solution. And then he notices, almost at the end of the deadline, that the spears that the guards were carrying had holes on their tips. And then he had the idea of passing the threads inside the eye of the needle rather than on the back of the needle. And hours later, he already had a prototype of the sewing machine, which really changed the economy worldwide. So this is a dream of tremendous impact. So even though dreaming is no longer considered a way to justify an idea, it still keeps giving us ideas that are tremendously important in real life.
Okay, so let's bring it home. Like literally, what can we do at home?
Well, I think the first thing is to talk about dreaming with your relatives, with your children, with your parents, with your spouse. Make it a topic of conversation. And then pay a lot of attention to dreaming two specific moments of your day. When you go to sleep, think to yourself, I will dream, I will remember, and I will report it. So you need to tell it to yourself a few times so that you really make some auto-suggestion that will point you in that direction. Then you will go through sleep, you'll have your dreams. And when you wake up in the morning, this is the most critical thing. Stay very quiet in bed. Stay very quiet. Don't move. Just grab a piece of paper and a pencil and write it down, or write it on your mobile, or even record the audio. But don't try to do anything else. If you move around, you will lose it. You will lose this very faint memory of the last images of the dream. But if you can hold on to it, and if you wait long enough in bed, your brain will begin to have norepinephrine available, and this will strengthen the reverberation of those memories. And then after a few days of practice, you'll be able to record many pages of dreams. And this has happened many times in my experience. I talked to many people about this, and it's almost always the case. Why? Because dreaming is as natural, as spontaneous as breathing. It's a biological power that we have that we must use to navigate the future. The future that we face now, this world that is so paradoxical, that is so rich, and nevertheless, things are not going so well. Part of the problem that we're having is that we lost the ability to investigate the consequences of our actions through dreaming. Our ancestors didn't have to be in a hurry every day. Occasionally, yes, but most of the time people were having a relaxed life. And we live constantly in fear of being late, of missing this or missing that, right? We react to the lack of real predators with a lot of fear and preoccupation towards very small things.
Yeah. You know, we don't know for a fact if anxiety and depression are escalating or just being diagnosed more, but it sure seems to me that some of the hurry and pressure, you know, the lack of reverie that you're referring to, would have to produce anxiety.
Yes, yes. And we should consider also, Eric, that we're living such a bombardment of images that are already complete, right? We're constantly watching screens. We're cutting short the space for imagination. Our imaginal world is everything is very literal. Everything is very fast. Everything is very colorful. Everything is very frantic. But this is not how we evolved. We evolved with a lot of contemplation, with a lot of nature contemplation, with a lot of human contemplation and interactions and dialogue.
And play.
Outright context.
Play imagination. Yes.
Play imagination. Yes. And narrative. Narratives are at the core of our mind. This is how our mind evolved. And now we're getting a lot of narrative, but it's all ready. It's all coming to the brain, and the brain has to take it and not really have time to come up with the details.
There's so much in here that is just like fundamental to what it means to be human. I was thinking, I assume that you have seen that Netflix special on the octopus, the guy who spent a year with the octopus.
Yes.
When you said the octopus's dream, I was like, yeah, of course they do.
we published this year. A student of mine, Sylvia Medeiros, was the first author of a paper in iScience showing that they have active sleep. But people knew some that they should have, because this has been filmed by many people and even posted on Twitter. However, skeptics would still say, maybe they're awake, because people were not able to record. Our study was to not only record the patterns and quantify them, but to stimulate the animals with images of moving crabs during various wake sleep states. And we found that during this particular state, which occupies only 0.5% of the time, of the total time of the animal, this particular state, they are totally unresponsive to stimulation. So they're really sleeping. And this happens every 30, 35 minutes for about 40 seconds or about a minute.
Okay.
So it's like a clock.
Just to clarify, you guys are doing research on octopus REM sleep.
Yes, yes, yes.
Oh, of course you are, because that's what you do. Hey, let me...
It's not in the book, because when I wrote the book, I was still... This was still ongoing experimentation. We hadn't published those findings. Those findings were published...
All right, let me conclude with a question, a tough question for you. In your first chapter of your book, I don't remember the exact language, so I'm going to paraphrase, but you just say, we're going to go on this journey, and you're going to have to drop a lot of your preconceptions. Mm-hmm. You remember that passage, right?
Yes.
Okay. Hamlet said, there are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy. My question is, are you willing to abandon your preconceptions and think that maybe there is something more going on than just simply adaptive success in all this?
It's a marvelous question. And I actually, at the end of the book, I respond to that. And what I say is the following. For most dream accounts that people have, we can give a parsimonious, materialist, rational, logical explanation if we consider all the evidence. It's complex, but it's very logical. And this is what the book tries to do. And it's for the readers to judge whether they are convinced. Now, I have heard people telling me of dream experiences that have a kind of precognitive or premonitory quality that doesn't seem to fit in this theory of a probabilistic oracle, right? The probabilistic oracle is not a deterministic oracle. It cannot tell the future as it will happen because it hasn't happened yet. But it's based on yesterday, how's tomorrow? That's the probabilistic oracle. Now, sometimes people say, well, I had this dream about something that I had no idea and I had no chance of knowing. And still I had the dream. And I must say, interesting. I'm a scientist. I'm ready for more data. But these things need to be well documented. Until they are, and until we have a scientific agreement about having convincing documentation, it's always possible that the person is making it up. Now, things can change dramatically with new experiments. For example, for years, many people in the field believed that dreams did not occur during sleep, but rather when people woke up, and that the feeling that they were occurring during sleep was a misunderstanding. And this was a legitimate philosophical question, and it was also a legitimate biological question for decades throughout the 20th century. But then in 2014, a team of Japanese researchers published a paper in Science showing that dreams can be decoded to some extent. So it's possible, based on brain activation patterns, to tell with some degree of confidence what people are experiencing subjectively during sleep.
You say this so matter-of-factly, but this is mind-blowing stuff.
It is. and actually work that has developed, and the book tells about a little bit about this, and it's quite interesting. But one thing that this experiment showed shows, and it's very important for the understanding of what dreaming is that the best decoding you can do is 10 seconds before the person wakes up, not after. So we now know for a fact that dreaming happens during sleep and not as some strange phenomenon at waking up. So this is an example in which people, important people in the field, had to change their minds. And they did, based on evidence.
Right. And so you, as a scientist, you have to, at some level, be a reductionist. And yet, at the same time, you are aware of those kind of boundaries and horizons where you can't really explain everything that's going on.
We need to keep our minds open. We just came out of the caves. Our development has been very fast in the past 300,000 years, which for biology is an instant.
Yeah. Well, this is great stuff. Siddhartha Hibero, the author of Oracle of Night, The History and Science of Dreams, somebody who has played an active role in reshaping how we understand this field over the last two decades. Siddhartha, thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much, Eric.
Eric Schultzke there with Dr. Hibero, and I'm Marcus Smith. One of the more intriguing suggestions to come out of Dr. Hibero's dream research is that schizophrenia may involve REM sleep spilling over into a person's waking hours. Coming up next on our show, we're going to hear from a young woman who lives with schizophrenia and has become a powerful voice to others like her. Stay tuned to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. It's a pleasure to have you listening today. We've been hearing about the emerging science of dreams, including the idea that, well, at least a hypothesis, that dreams overlap with another object of confusion and mystery in brain science. I'm talking about schizophrenia. Researchers are gaining ground on this topic, just not as fast as we would like. To learn more about living with the condition, I spoke a while back with Cecilia McGow. McGow is founder and CEO of Students with Psychosis, and here's part of our conversation.
Being open about my schizophrenia is one of the best decisions I think I've ever made, because I lived for so many years in fear of what other people would think of me because of my diagnosis. And now that I am not living in that fear or living with that secret anymore, it's helped really empower me in a way, and has also helped me with my mental illness.
And you have a chance to speak primarily, as I understand it, on college campus. Is that right?
That is correct. I am lucky enough that I do talk to students on campuses, and I also go and speak at different events. I was lucky enough back in the spring to be a speaker at NAMI's state conference in Ohio. So I absolutely love doing the public guest speaking. But my primary work that I do is founding Students with Schizophrenia, so that I'm helping fellow people like myself who have schizophrenia and students reaching their dreams of getting that degree.
And for those people who haven't heard of NAMI or NAMI, I've heard it said both ways, that's the National Association for or of
Mental Illness.
Mental illness, yeah. Are you still in college?
Yes, I am currently at Penn State University.
And I understand that you have quite the scientific background, too. You are studying something that has to do with stuff I would never understand. Tell us about that.
For quite a while, I was studying astronomy and astrophysics at Penn State. So I got really interested in astronomy back in high school. Quite a space nerd, actually. I was collaborated with the Pulsar Search Collaboratory, and in high school, I was lucky enough to have actually co-discovered a pulsar. A pulsar is a super dense neutron star that emits dipole electromagnetic radiation, and it really opened some doors for me, such as I was a Virginia Aerospace Science and Technology Scholar through NASA, and also helped represent the United States in the International Space Olympics in Russia.
So everything you have just said goes against a typical, well, a stereotype, because we
in American society for many years, we don't think, I don't know why, I mean, we don't think of science and scholarship and intellectual prowess coming together with schizophrenia. Am I wrong about that stereotype? It seems to me that that's kind of where we've been.
True, there is that sort of stereotype that that someone with schizophrenia can't accomplish their dreams or can't pursue a science, technology, engineering, or mathematics career. So there is that stereotype. There's quite a few different stereotypes associated with schizophrenia. So that's one of them. But also on the flip side, sometimes people think of schizophrenia as because they think of the different media representations also of schizophrenia. So there's that movie, A Beautiful Mind, for example. I don't know if you've watched that. It's reaccounting John Nash's life, who got a Nobel Prize. And so sometimes people sort of have the stereotype of like, oh, you must be really smart. You have schizophrenia, or, oh, you can't accomplish your dreams. But sort of both stereotypes aren't that good, because say, for example, when I was studying astronomy and astrophysics, I was studying astronomy and astrophysics because I was interested and I loved it, and it wasn't because I had schizophrenia. So we just need to try to stay away from both type of stereotypes.
Yeah, it's almost as though we jump into the cause and effect scenarios and we think we know all of the effects of all the causes, or we want to see like a one-to-one correspondence that, well, this person did this because of fill in the blank. And in your case, somebody would say, well, that's what we should expect from somebody suffering from schizophrenia, right?
Right, right. And with someone who has schizophrenia, that's just a small facet of them. It's not their whole identity. I'm very much a person-first terminology. Like when we were founding students with schizophrenia, we called it students with schizophrenia, not like something like schizophrenic students or something like that, because it's not our whole identity. It is just a part of just a small part of who we are and not our full identity.
I almost used the word schizophrenic and backed off of it and then said a person suffering with schizophrenia. On a day-to-day basis, we're so accustomed to going down that road. Do you get opportunity to explain to your audiences this whole notion of why the person-first terminology is so important?
Yeah. So again, I am a strong advocate for person-first terminology because I think it's important to make sure that we are talking about that person. And but also I want to be on sort of the talk about the sort of flip side of that as well, because there are advocates out there that mental health advocates out there that are proud of calling themselves a schizophrenic. And I don't want to in any way offend them. If that person is empowered by reclaiming that word, then I all power to them. But when talking about people in general who have schizophrenia, or someone who doesn't have schizophrenia, we think, yeah, using that person-first terminology is appropriate.
Cecilia McGow, founder and CEO of Students with Psychosis. We're going on a tour to see some vanishing places, before they're gone, that is, next on Constant Wonder.